Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today's show, from New York, from Manhattan, novelist, short story writer, and essayist Janice Itis has twice won the O. Henry Prize for her short stories, as well as a Pushcart Prize, a Red Book Prize, and the Acker Award for Fiction, among many others. Her 2008 novel, The War of the Rosens, won an Independent Publishers Award in Religion and was nominated for the prestigious Sophie Brody Medal, an award for the most distinguished contribution to Jewish literature for adults. Janice's latest novel, The Last Jewish Virgin, was published in the fall of 2010. Marianne Winnick, an NPR commentator, called it Twilight with a sense of humor, a brain, and a feminist subtext. Janice's other books include the short story collections The Celibacy Club and Vito Loves Geraldine, and the novels Urban Bliss and Faithful Rebecca. Actively engaged in a lifelong love affair with contemporary culture, Janice has published in such anthologies as Mondo Elvis and Mondo James Dean, and she is the co-editor of It's Only Rock and Roll, an anthology of rock and roll short stories. She's currently the fiction editor at Shaking, the print and online journal. Writing about issues of Jewish identity, sometimes with humor and always with affection, her work appears in such magazines as Tikkun and Jewish Currents, and the anthologies Promised Lands, New Jewish American Fiction on Longing and Belonging, the Oxford Book of Jewish Stories, Neurotica, Jewish Writers on Sex, and Scribblers on the Roof, Contemporary Jewish Fiction. Her writings about women's issues and writers' issues can be found in the anthologies Desire, Women Write About Wanting, Dirt, The Quirks, Habits, and Passions of Keeping House, Sleeping with One Eye Open, Survival Strategies for Women Writers, and Growing Up Female. Janice is a frequent guest speaker and teacher throughout the U.S., Europe, and Central America. And I want to give you a warm welcome to our show, Janice. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I think it's going to be great fun to talk about your career, which has taken some interesting turns from where you started in fiction to where you're working today quite a lot in personal essay. So let's talk about how you started being a writer.
I have always written for as long as I can remember, since I was a little girl, and I started writing poetry when I was really little, and actually my first publications were poetry. And I remember as a child, one of my first poems was, I love the city, it is so pretty. And I still write a lot about how I love New York City. So I think that's interesting how I knew even back then one of my themes. And then I went from poetry to writing short stories when I was in my 20s. And I quickly realized that I felt more like a prose writer, more like a fiction writer, because I love telling a story. And I do love the music of poetry and the music of language and nuance in words, but at my heart, I'm really a yarn spinner. I really like telling a tale.
Did you find that poetry helped you in some way in your fiction?
Very much so. I mean, poetry made me focus on details, visual imagery, the music of language, being present at a moment. Fiction is very much about scenes, and poetry led me to be able to focus in concrete ways on discrete moments like that.
That's wonderful. I believe that poetry is a very fabulous homepage for any writer, that there's poetry in all of us, and when we can tap into it, everything becomes more immediate. Do you agree?
I totally agree. And for me, my favorite writing of all kinds, prose and theater, always has poetry in the language. And that can express itself in different ways. I mean, it doesn't always have to be long, eloquent, poetic sentences, but there needs to be some kind of intrinsic poetry in language for me to really be engaged.
In my own work, I always feel that personal essay is like a close cousin to poetry. And I know lately you've been writing quite a few personal essays for different venues. I'm wondering if you have any of that same experience.
Well, it is interesting because I have fallen in love with writing relatively short personal essays, and it does bring me back to days when I wasn't thinking always in terms of 300-page novels. For a number of years, my brain always went to writing long works, and that was how I sort of envisioned my personal literary landscape. But nowadays, I'm finding it wonderfully challenging and exciting to be able to kind of say succinctly in a poetic way the truth of my life and sort of mining my own life in these ways for personal essays.
Are you still writing novels as well?
At the moment, I'm really focusing on nonfiction. I believe that I have the kind of brain where everything is always percolating at once. So I'm always jotting down notes for ideas for all different genres. But right now, I have to say that the personal essay is just something I'm sort of embracing. And I feel like my career has gone, it's really been a journey and a process. And I feel that sometimes it comes full circle and sometimes it takes unexpected detours.
Mm-hmm. I know from your work that I have included in some of my own publications that I edited that 9/11 affected you very deeply in New York, and you wrote quite a stunning personal essay about how you decided after 9/11 to become a parent.
Well, first, let me thank you for being so generous over the years and including my work in your anthologies, which has always been thrilling, and in your books. And yeah, I was invited to write an essay for a collection called 110 Stories, which was the height of world trade, and 110 writers who were in New York at that time were invited to write short essays about their experience. And for me, it was very personal. I lived very near to World Trade Center, and I was actually teaching a class that morning at the New School. And my students and I all ran outside because we heard and were told what was going on, and we stood on the street together, and the class was very early in the semester. We barely knew each other, and we stood together and watched the tower fall and how we all experienced that as a group. And my husband at the time was working at St. Vincent's Hospital, which was ground zero hospital for what was going on, and he was working in mental health services and helping many people who had lost people or lost businesses, and firefighters and policemen who had been there. So it really affected us very personally and very deeply, as it did everybody, and we were there geographically and very much a part of it.
Your essay from that experience and for that anthology was very moving to me because I have a very deeply held belief in the idea that what matters is continuance. And when our lives are most threatened and the lives of our culture and our society, that kicks in. And it makes perfect sense to me that a decision that would be quite a turning point in your life to raise a child would come out of the, like a phoenix rising out of the ashes of the horror. And I am wondering today whether that was that a pivotal essay for you in terms of moving towards nonfiction?
I think it probably was, because what happened to me was after I witnessed it, I couldn't write for 4 months, and they were four very long months, and I couldn't write anything. I couldn't write fiction. I couldn't write nonfiction. I was really traumatized, as many, many people were, and I just felt that I had no voice as a writer. And then the editor invited me to be part of this anthology, and the floodgates opened, and I found myself with something to say that I really did want to say. And after that, I was able to write again, but I needed that at that time. And then to bring it back to what you said about my husband and I making the decision afterwards to become parents, we had been wrestling with the idea of becoming first-time middle-aged parents, which was not something we had really been thinking about for a number of years. And then we began thinking about it, but we had a lot of work to do to make that decision. We didn't come by that decision lightly. And then after 9/11, we felt very strongly that what you said, the continuance, that we did want to become parents, and we chose to adopt a little girl from Guatemala. And there was a kind of circle to it and a moving forward at the same time.
So it seems to me very much to parallel what we do when we're writing personal essays. And one of the venues that you publish in that I didn't mention in your bio is Purple Clover, an online publication. And I know that you've prepared something for us to read from one of your short essays. And this might be a good time for that.
First, I'll tell you a little bit about Purple Clover. It's an online magazine, and what I love about it is every week it publishes at least a dozen or more really interesting short literary essays about a wide variety of subjects by a very diverse and wide group of writers, and people really delve into their personal lives in these short pieces that, as I said, revolve every week, and I just think it's a wonderful magazine. And it's aimed at baby boomers, although that's defined very, very broadly, and it's very clear to me from reading it that, in fact, people of all ages are reading it and writing for it, and so it's a wonderful magazine, and I've been a regular contributor for about a year and a half. The essay that I've chosen to read today is one of the earliest pieces that I published for them, and it's called My Guru, My Best Friend, and it's about my lifelong and very complicated relationship with my childhood best friend who grew up to be a very, very different person from me, which I think is inevitable but not necessarily easy. So, My Guru, My Best Friend. During the 10-year period when Sarah lived in India and belonged to a cult, she and I rarely spoke. Whenever we did talk briefly by phone, I couldn't stand how often she said, "Guru this and guru that." Gradually, our sporadic phone calls stopped altogether. Back then, I frequently lamented to the man I'd married that Sarah had been my first great love. I never imagined life without her, I told him so many times. He probably grew sick of hearing me say it. Although I was happily married, a part of me was in chronic mourning over the loss of my best friend. When Guru moved from India to the U.S., Sarah followed him to his new intentional community. The community quickly became known for its wild sex and its enmity toward the local citizenry who didn't want the community in their midst. Eventually, Guru was arrested for, among other things, a bioterror attack on the locals. He was deported back to India. Sarah moved to Hawaii then, no longer considering herself Guru's follower. "I forgive him," she told me when she called out of the blue. "He's now like a flawed father to me." With Guru out of the picture, I wanted her back in my life. I told myself that I would need to tolerate her woo-woo beliefs. Once, I complained to her about my job. She told me that if I inhaled the scent of a particular flower, a new job would come to me. "That's ridiculous," I snapped, letting her know that I definitely hadn't forgiven her for choosing Guru and his new agey philosophy over me, and perhaps I never would. I'd met Sarah in fifth grade in our Bronx elementary school. The first thing I noted about her were her two red Pippi Longstocking braids. She and I fell in love instantly. We wrote plays and stories together and acted them out for any neighborhood kids who were interested. We invented a secret language. We sat side by side and drew portraits of one another. With her, my creativity flourished in ways it never had. Throughout middle school and high school, Sarah and I saw each other every day. After school, we spoke on the phone for hours. She made me laugh, and I was fundamentally a sad kid due to a depressed mother and violent father. She promised that when we grew up, I would be a writer and she would be my literary agent. Our gestures and vocal intonations became identical. It was Sarah to whom I turned for solace and understanding, finding so little of that at home. We went to the same college and moved in with each other after graduation to a two-bedroom apartment in a tenement building close to Grand Central. Our boyfriends were friends. We continued to collaborate artistically. But then she took off to India where she wanted to live free. I didn't go with her, although she asked me to. My contempt for her new life was obvious. I didn't try hard to conceal it. All I wanted to do was write, save enough money to go to grad school, and teach. In Hawaii, where she'd gone after Guru was deported, Sarah supported herself as a yoga teacher and massage therapist. We started emailing and speaking by phone as often as we could. She never backed down on her ideas, despite knowing how little respect I had for them. Gradually, I learned to love her again, to accept her New Age beliefs about flowers, reincarnation, and sexual experimentation as the key to the spirit within. I no longer felt superior to her. Her beliefs were a part of who she was, and I loved all of her. Once again, she helped me to flourish, this time to become more tolerant and understanding. Sarah died suddenly a few years ago of an aneurysm, and I lost my guru, who had taught me so much.
Thank you, Janice. It takes quite a turn at the end. Beautiful. Thank you.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila Bender talks with fiction and nonfiction writer Janice Itis about the pleasures of writing in the two genres.
I know you write on many personal topics. One that's coming to mind right now is writing about whether single men and women can be friends. Can you just kind of list off some of the other topics people can find if they look up Janice Itis, Purple Clover?
Well, I've written a lot about my sort of love affair / hate affair with technology, because I'm as addicted as the next person to technology, but I also am a klutz. When it comes to technology, I'm technophobic, I'm fearful, I make mistakes. So there's just this ongoing thing that I have about it. So I've written a few pieces about that. I've also written pieces about sort of how we change when we find ourselves in long-term relationships. For example, I was always a classic flirt, and how through being in a long-term solid relationship, I've really changed. I would say flirtation is no longer part of my character, and how that's really been an interesting evolution for me. I've written about parenting and the complications of parenting. I've written about travel. I've written about giving up dreams that one has. So it's really been a wide variety.
It sounds like fun and challenging and an effort to get at some personal truths that I'm sure are universal. So thanks for the list, and I advise everyone to go visit Purple Clover and then also type in Janice Itis, E-I-D-U-S. And while I'm talking about it, I don't want to neglect your significant fiction. And if you go to Janice's website, Janice, J-A-N-I-C-E, EIDUS.com, you're going to find descriptions of her novels and other work. And speaking of those novels, Janice, I am familiar with them both, and of course most recently read The Last Jewish Virgin. I agree with the NPR reviewer who said it was Twilight with a sense of humor and brains. How in the world did you come to the idea of writing a vampire novel?
The interesting thing was, I have adored the vampire myth since I was a kid. I always watched every vampire movie that I could, and I would make comparisons with them. I loved the funny ones and the dark ones and the horrible ones and the romantic ones. I was really, really drawn to the myth. And then I read Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I just thought it was a brilliant, brilliant novel. I mean, absolutely brilliant. And it's all about class issues, and it's got a feminist subtext, which is kind of not necessarily overtly evident. But anyway, it's an extraordinary book, and I loved it. And I'm always meeting people who say, oh, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was the great book. And I have to disagree and say, for me, it was really Dracula. But what I had no idea, and I'd always assumed as a writer that one day I would write my literary vampire novel, and I immersed myself in vampire literature and criticism and film, but I had no idea that a lot of other people had the same obsession with the myth as I did. So it was fascinating to me when my book came out and other things were happening at the same time that were very vampire-centric. So it was as though I had entered something that was so much a part of the culture, and I honestly hadn't realized that.
Interesting. But you do have your finger on American culture, for sure, from your other interests in writing. It was a really fun read, and it does have brains as well, but the humor in it and the conglomeration of characters, a socialist Jewish mother and her daughter who wants to become a fashion designer and a music instructor, all of those people together at a school, which I assume is a lot like the one that you told us you had been teaching at, the new school, everything takes place in Manhattan, is really a remarkable conglomeration.
Well, thank you. It was tremendous fun to write. I mean, as I said, I had immersed myself in vampire lore, so I was able to pay homage to the vampire myth while subverting it and tweaking it. And I also used it to explore feminism and the generation gap between feminist mothers and quote-unquote post-feminist daughters. And I felt that I was in every character in the book, that there was a part of me in the mother and a part of me in the daughter and a part of me in this kind of sexy male vampire that I created, and this ethical young man who's sort of the opposite of the vampire. And I had a ball. And I hope readers had a ball reading it.
I did reading it. And listening to you talk today, I can see how your themes and your interests are all woven into that book as well. I know you do a lot of teaching, and I'm wondering, for those people who are listening and writing or wanting to write, what is your best advice to people who are about to venture into writing?
The main advice that I give to all my students of all ages, wherever they are in their careers, is to read, 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 read. And I think they need to read very, very broadly, and mean outside of their comfort zones and outside of what they're used to. So if they're a 25-year-old memoirist, I think they should be reading 70-year-old novelists and poets. And I think if they live in the U.S., they should be reading African writers and Latin American writers. And I think that if they're straight, they should be reading gay writers, as well, obviously, as writers with whom they do have more in common in those ways. But I think that the way we really learn and really learn how to be thinkers and writers and take risks is to read as broadly as we can.
So do you have an example of some way that maybe you've done it too, where something so unlike what you write has entered your consciousness and helped you be more risk-taking in your writing, say?
I just finished a very interesting memoir called All Who Go Do Not Return, and it's a first memoir by a young male writer named Shulam Dean, and it is about his growing up in a very, very strict and very insular and censorious Hasidic community in upstate New York, and how he lost his faith and became labeled a heretic and was expelled from the community, and how he found the courage of his convictions and the life he was able to lead when he left, and he lost his marriage and he lost communication with his children. It's nothing like my own experience as a human being, as a Jew. We couldn't be further apart, and yet I thought it was a very compelling book, and I loved reading about his courage, and I identified with it, even though our paths have been so different.
But it was fortifying to read about courage, and I do think that what we take away from stories is not only a cultural experience, but that universal experience of some feeling that we identify with. So thank you for that advice, and I hope people listening follow it. I hope it helps me browse through my own collection of books and read some of the ones I've put off reading because they're so different from what I write. Before we end today, I'm wondering if you'd like to tell us something that you find really wonderful about the writing life.
Well, there are so many things, Sheila, as I'm sure you know too, about what's wonderful about the writing life. But I think for me, I love having found a job and a career where I really can express myself. I grew up in a family where I was not rewarded. In fact, I was often punished for speaking my mind, expressing my feelings, giving my own opinions. And I have heard it said, and it's certainly true for me and many people that I know, that people who become writers are people who felt they were never listened to enough when they were growing up. And we spend the rest of our lives making our way to be heard and communicating our feelings and who we are and our opinions and our thoughts. And I think that I love the fact that I found exactly the right career to do that.
That's very well said, Janice. I know it's been true for me. And I also know that as a teacher, that's another, when you teach writing as well as you do, it's another way to affirm that what you see and hear and think about is of value to other people. I think it's a good combination, becoming a writer and teaching.
I agree.
So I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Again, I want to tell people to visit you at www.janiceidus.com. Again, it's E-I-D-U-S is Idus. Look at Purple Clover and to find your way around many other publications by Janice that you can find online by typing her name in. Thank you again.
Thank you, Sheila.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.